The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 424 for Sunday, November 11th, 2012.
Dave Hamilton and John F. Braun. They are the geeks that turn us on. Talking Mac and iOS. And Pilot Pete might be the guest. They often speak in terminal. They make it cool if you don't know. Just stick around, you'll understand just how to enter those commands. Dave Hamilton and John F. Braun. Don't get caught.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions, you send in your tips, you send in cool stuff found, we provide some answers, we share all of the rest, and together, we all try to learn a lot each and every time we get together every week. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
And here, just amazed at what I just heard in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun. And you know, Dave, that tempts me, you know, as you probably, I think I mentioned, but I'm a sax player, or I used to be a sax player, and I still have a sax. And every now and then I'll break it out, and it still works. Mm-hmm. Though I still have, apparently, they have made advances in reed technology. No, they're not bamboo anymore, or at least they don't have to be. But and I think you sent me the music, Dave. So it's
a riff on the major six chord, if I'm thinking right.
Well, I can't do chords. Six. It's a saxophone.
Well, no. But I mean, it's the structure of it is just that one. Yeah. And then of course it's just a 1-4-5 progression. But that was Kurt Lee had sent that in this week.
Outstanding.
It was awesome. Awesome stuff, man. Gosh, that's awesome. I love that kind of stuff for obvious reasons, but I mean, I love it, you know, for what it is too. It's really appreciate when you folks get involved. And of course, that's really what the show is everybody getting involved. So we have a lot of stuff to go through as always, the mailbag overflowing as always. But then, you know, it's getting into what I will call Christmas season, but really by that I mean, you know, very non-denominational, the season where
holidays.
Yeah, the season where we all, at least in America and perhaps elsewhere in the world, we all spend a little bit more money than we normally would and buy gifts for each other and stimulate the economy in our own way. So that's what's coming up. And so we've got some gift suggestions for all of you, and we will we'll talk about some of those this week and some next week and some the following week, and then I think we're off for a week, and then we'll talk about more, and we'll keep doing this probably right up until about the middle of December when that whole thing starts to wind down. But let's start with Larry, shall we, John?
Indeed.
All right. Larry writes, I've been using the command from within Word for Mac 2011 file share email as attachment until about 3 weeks ago, when clicking on that command would bring the mail app window to the front and then nothing would happen. When mousing over the Word doc I wanted to attach, I'd see the spinning beach ball for 30 seconds or so. Then the beach ball would stop spinning and nothing else would happen. I've reverted to saving the file and then attaching it by using a paperclip icon in Mail and navigating through the Finder. Not the easiest, but certainly doable. I then created a test user account to see if the problem was system-wide, and it is not. Excellent troubleshooting, Larry. So I know now that I have an issue with my primary user account. What would you recommend to troubleshoot further and fix? And please don't say use Pages, although I'm seriously considering it. Actually, Larry, I don't think Pages would have helped because, as Larry already knows, the problem is solved because Larry solved it. He says, good news. I realized that I hadn't done a repair permissions on this drive in a long time, so I did that, and it solved the problem. And that is the solution to remember for this type of thing, because even though you're emailing a file and you're saying write from in Word, send it to Mail, it actually has to save it on disk somewhere, and then it goes into Mail. And if the permissions on that somewhere folder are munged up, then you're not going to be able to save the file there, and Mail and Word can't communicate by way of this. So so that's what you need to do. And that's the solution most of the time for this. So thank you, Larry, for the question and for the answer. We like that. That's good. But it's a good tip nonetheless.
What concerns me what I'm scratching my head over, Dave, and I had not looked into this, and maybe you know,
yeah,
or someone knows, but to me, it sounds like what this was doing was, now, I don't know if this was a necessarily a word specific function.
Yeah.
If you get where I'm going here, if it was a problem with Word or if it was a problem with the part of the OS that lets other applications ask it to do nice things like this. You see where I'm going with this?
You may be right. I mean, certainly you can do it from the file print dialog. You can say mail as PDF. Right. That's right. And that would be the system wide way. You might be right. This might have been a Word specific issue. Very good point. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, no, I'm thinking that it was not. In that they were calling a facility that is advertised. So mail may allow, and it may be a little of both. So maybe Microsoft put together a little piece of code that is smart enough to say, hey, mail, by the way, here's this document. You want to help me out here?
Right.
And for whatever reason, so I suspect, but he solved the problem. But I suspect whether it was a Word, a part of Word or a part of Mac OS that was not set up right, whatever he did fixed it. If anybody knows, I'd be very interested because I see things in the share menu that look like they may be OS level things versus Word specific things because it's a common function.
I think you're probably You're probably right that you know, baked into Word is some access to this common function. So yeah, a little bit of both I think is a good way of saying it. I saw the same problem actually. Jeff Quistad over at Backbeat Media had the same issue with FileMaker. And you know, we have a little script where he can send out orders directly as a PDF from it, and it wouldn't work. It was the same exact symptoms. You know, you would hit the thing, it would run the script, and nothing would happen except it would spin like a beach ball for a while. But if he went to file and print and did it save, it would work, you know, save as PDF and then attach it that way, it would work just fine. So yeah, I think you're probably right. It's probably a little bit of both. All right, cool. You know, in the last show, where we didn't talk about anything old, it was only new stuff, we had someone asking about correcting an autocorrect entry on iOS. And Bob Levitis heard that. And actually, you know, our solution for that, John, was you got to wipe out the whole autocorrect library. And Bob figured out a hack, which I really, really liked. So here we go.
This is for the guy who wanted to correct an autocorrect entry. I have a thought that will probably work. Go into Settings, General, Keyboard, Shortcuts, and create a shortcut that replaces the bad signature with the good signature. That way, when it corrects it and types that, when you put the space after, it'll change it back to the good signature. I'm pretty sure it'll work if you type everything correctly. That's all for now. This is Bob in Austin, Texas. Take care.
Thanks, Bob. Yeah, I think that would work. That is a good workaround for that on iOS. it's also helpful to use that workaround if there's something you type regularly that the system wants to autocorrect to, you know, a word for whatever reason. You can go put both entries in. You can put the same thing into to the shortcut, and then it won't autocorrect because it sees, oh, you typed this, you meant to type this, and it, even though they're the same thing, the system says, yep, that's okay, that's cool. So, tis good.
Yeah, thanks, yeah. Bob.
Yeah, thanks, Bob. Yeah, thanks, Bob. Yeah.
And remember, folks, he's not a real doctor, though. He probably should be.
I'm not sure what that means, but yes.
I'm not either.
But he knows, and that's the most important part. Yes, you want to tell us about Randall, John?
I'm going to tell you about Randall. So Randall writes, my iMac, paren, lion, close paren, won't keep removed login items deleted. Why? I went to System Preferences, Users and Groups, Login Items as the admin and only account on the Mac and deleted a number of applications and items using the minus sign. They all went away. Upon reboot, however, they all came back. I've done it several times with the same results. I also used Clean Genius to do the same thing with the same lack of results. None of the helps or my manual have any note on how to deal with this problem. I'm left with only one alternative, remove the programs. However, I still want to use a couple of them. I just don't want them coming up at login. Well, my response to this, it sounds to me like what the problem is. So I responded to Randall like this. And I said, Randall, it sounds like one of the plist files that stores the login items is damaged or corrupt, as evidenced by your being able to change the values. And it seems to accept them, but they never take hold in the file system. Because I suspect what's happening is they are not being written or written correctly to the plist file. Now, in this case, rather than using the most recent preferences modified trick, I was pretty sure I knew which file was involved here, Dave. And I think the file or files, because it's stored like many things in the Mac, they're stored in multiple locations. So this is a preference file where preference is stored. For the most part, they're stored as plist files in a preferences directory. And this could either be a tilde library preferences, or to translate that into English, it's your home directory, which you're going to see in your left sidebar. You will see a little house. That's your home directory. And then within that, well, you won't see library normally with the latest versions of macOS, but if you hold down option, I believe, and you go to the, which is it here? Go menu, then you will see library, and then you can dig a little deeper and there'll be a preferences folder. And there's also one at the top level library preferences directory. And I suspect the file or files you want to look for, because there's a few of them, would be the com.apple.loginitems.whatever. And I've seen plist, and I've also seen lock files have come up as of late.
Yep.
So in my opinion, what's wrong here is that plist file is doing something wrong, or it's preventing something from happening. So my suggestion would be make note of all the programs. And if you do, if you go to your, I believe it's accounts, and you eventually you get into a login items area, you're going to see a list of programs. And let me make sure here.
So yeah, system, that's right. Yes. System
groups. Good.
Yeah, you got it. Go ahead.
Okay. And within there, you will see all the programs that are being launched as login items. What I would do is make a note of those or make a backup of the file, because you want them later. And then the reason I say this is because in my opinion, the one way to try to solve this problem is to whack all of those com.apple.loginitems.whatever files in both locations. Then add them all back and see if things improve. And we haven't heard back yet, but that's the way I would solve this problem. And that's why I think this is happening. It's a damaged plist file.
Yeah, or a bad permission on a plist file.
Correct. Yes.
A couple of things to add. You said to save the contents of that login item screen so that you can refer back to it later if you have to wipe it out and put things back in. For stuff like that, man, I am a screenshot fool on my Mac. Yep. I would do a Command Shift 4 and then hit the space bar to turn it into the save the whole window thing, and then just click on that window and to your desktop folder, it will save screenshot with a timestamp, and you can go back to that and see it and bring it up. So that's how I would deal with that part of it. And I will take this opportunity, John, to say hello to everyone that has joined us in the chat room for this show here. Hello to everybody in the chat room. That's at MacGeekGab.com/stream. And Patronus in the chat room has suggested a couple of things to fix this. Number one is, I'm assuming it's a he, but it may very well be a she. But Patronus says a safe boot fixes that. And so you go in, you reboot the machine, hold down the shift key right at reboot, and that will put the Mac into safe mode. So going into safe mode and then coming back out and rebooting regularly can fix that. And then he also says Yasu, which is yet another system utility, may fix that as well. So two things to talk about there. It's good stuff, right?
No, whatever solves the problem.
Well, that's really what it's all about. That's right. Yeah. So thanks, Patronus, and thanks everybody in the chat room there. Yeah, Yasu. That's another good one from Jim Mitchell.
Yeah, I haven't really looked at that one. I'm an Onyx type of guy.
So I'm gonna jump around. The one thing that kind of brought Yasu to our attention, what was it, a month or two ago, was that it was the first utility that we had found that would allow you not only to repair system-wide permissions, but also the permissions of your user folder, which otherwise you had to do this weird reboot and go to the terminal thing to do. So that Yasu will do it, but and I'm looking here because I want to make sure I get who it was that said it, but I'm not going to get it, am I? But Onyx now does that too. The new version of Onyx will allow you to repair user permissions. And by golly, I am determined to figure out who it was that told us about that, but I may fail in this mission. There it is. It was Jeff who said that Onyx now repairs user permissions. I'm trying to see if he said anything more specific than that. And no, that's what he said, was Onyx repairs user permissions. So thank you, Jeff, for that. So yeah, you're good with Onyx, John, or with Yasu. So good stuff. All right. While we're back in follow-up mode, we talked about clamshell mode, John, in Mac Geek Gab 323, and Zach wrote in and pointed out something very interesting about clamshell mode. We had recommended that you, as always, not run your Mac attached to battery power all the time, because that's not a great thing for your Mac's battery all the time. It's good to keep the electrons flowing in one direction or another. But Zach says, as a Mac consultant, I often get calls from clients or friends or family running in clamshell mode saying the screen went dark. It is almost always that the MagSafe adapter has been brushed off its target or the AC is unplugged. He says it is mandatory for clamshell mode, in his experience, to have AC power plugged in. So I thought that was interesting. I have run in clamshell mode so infrequently that I cannot really speak to this, but I'll take Zach and his word. So if you're having problems with clamshell mode, it may be that you have to stay plugged in, which of course is not all that great for your battery. So bear that in mind. Interesting, right, John?
You know, I seem to recall something. It may have been an article about that basically said, in a lot of situations, you do not, or the machine will act in unexpected ways if you are not running on both battery and AC power. I remember this. I think it was some articles that had to do with the performance of the machine. I think that the machine may go into a lower performance mode if it's not running off of AC versus battery power. I'll see if I can find it.
Okay.
But I definitely remember something related to this.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd be curious if there's anything about clamshell mode and battery power. I was sort of hoping that that you would have found some knowledge base article that said that, you know, explained all of this, but perhaps not. All right. While on the subject of our last show and also clamshell mode, Rob, let's see. Rob asked, just a quick question, which was inspired by the clamshell mode discussion. I also use my Retina 15-inch with a Thunderbolt display. While doing so, I have it connected to the MagSafe from the Thunderbolt to keep the battery charged / topped off while in my home office. As I'm sure you are probably aware, one of the key differences between the 13-inch and 15-inch Retina units is that only the 15-inch features discrete graphics, meaning it has its own separate graphics chip. So my question is, do you know of a way, only while in clamshell mode, of course, to force the use of the discrete adapter, or does it do this anyway to drive the Thunderbolt? Logic being that while on AC, why not leverage the full power of the GPU? And yeah, my belief, Rob, is that it is doing this automatically, but there's a couple of ways that you can check. The energy saver on those machines should actually have a little checkbox, or a radio button rather, at the top that says for graphics, higher battery life or better performance. And you can toggle back and forth between the two. So that should let you choose. The other thing to look at is an app that we've referred to most likely in the past, called GFX Card Status at gfx.io, that will let you not only see what it is, but also change it. So between one of those two things, you hopefully should see what you got going on. Good stuff. Did you find some knowledge base article while we were going through Rob's thing there, John?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right. So was Zach right? Do we need the AC adapter for clamshell mode?
No. Really? Now, it was a different article, and okay. It's titled MacBook and MacBook Pro. Mac reduces processor speed when battery is removed while operating from an AC adapter.
Oh, I see. Okay, so that's not about clamshell mode specifically, no. though. Okay.
No, but it is commenting on, what the machine does when you have a combination of power sources or not.
Right.
And I think when we found this, it surprised us. I'm like, well, why are you doing that? Well, I don't know.
Yeah. All right. I think it's time to, let's go to Felix. Because Felix has he's got a question. He says, my father recently realized that some of his contacts were missing. He has his contacts in Contacts app in Mountain Lion, and they sync to his iDevices via iCloud. We tried to recover them through Time Machine, but without success. I then thought we should try iCloud to see if we can restore to a point in time like you can in Gmail contacts or a la Time Machine. But it seems that iCloud does not offer this feature at all, which is something I would like other listeners to know about. How long does iCloud keep backups of contacts? As it is synchronizing deletions, it's worth knowing this. Delving deeper into the Time Machine problem, after having done that restore, the contacts were completely empty, apart from the iCloud contacts. Also in iCloud contacts, we were not able to click on the All iCloud group, only the custom address books group that we created. My dad has just below 2,000 contacts, and I'm wondering if they need to be cleaned. There are lots of duplicate addresses within each contact, things that mysteriously multiply with each sync, stuff like that. Do you have any suggestions? All right, so a couple of things here. First, you're right. iCloud does not store or let you access. It may store, but it does not let you access backups of contacts in any way that I've ever found. Once it's deleted from iCloud store or deleted from your Mac and then synced to iCloud, it, I believe, is unrecoverable, certainly from the cloud. The general concept is that you would have a backup on your Mac, but that clearly doesn't hold water for folks who only use iCloud's contacts on their iDevices and may not even own a Mac, which is not quite your situation. But like you said, worth noting so that people know, once you delete it, it's gone. There's no undo that we've found, or at least not that I've found. John, have you found one before we move on to other stuff here with Felix?
Maybe, but I'll get to it in a moment.
All right. So you want me to keep going here?
Go.
Okay. OS X's address book, which, is now Contacts. I'm still in Lion mode sometimes, doesn't offer much. But as far as the duplicates go, you can go to the card menu in Contacts and choose Look for Duplicates. That might be a place to start. Third-party software includes Contacts Cleaner, which is from Spanning Sync. And while I can't remember, honestly, if I've ever used it, but I know tons of our listeners have recommended Contacts Cleaner as a solution there. So that may help. And the fact that you're getting stuff duplicated on every sync makes me think that somewhere, be it locally on your Mac or somewhere in iCloud, you've got low level corruption of your contacts database, because that's not normal behavior. I have quite a few contacts out there, and as do many folks, and it's just not a commonly reported thing. So I think you might have some specific issues with that. In Contacts, go to the File menu, choose Export, and export a contacts archive. That is essentially a backup of everything that's in there. Then you clean everything out, and then file import that back in. As far as cleaning it all out, there's a couple of ways to do this, but I think honestly, I mean, you could select all and delete right from there, but you could also, maybe that is the best way. What would be the best way to delete stuff from Contacts, John? We could go to Home, Library. Right. I mean, you know, start digging around in there, but that I get,
what are you thinking, man?
Yeah, that's bad. Right. So
I wouldn't touch that.
Yeah. Yeah. So what are your thoughts on this, John?
Well, I did a little quick research here. And so one thing that I would encourage Felix to maybe try again. So let me look through here, because he was talking about Time Machine. Now, the only thing I'm going to say, so basically what I did is I went on my Mountain Lion machine and I fired up Contacts. Is that what they call it this week?
Yes. Yeah. This year. Okay. It's not this week. It's just this year. Yeah.
Oh, I'm trying to be funny.
I know.
And failing miserably. So if you start up contacts, what you're going to notice is that you can activate Time Machine. Here's the only thing I would say is that I noticed this, at least on my system, Dave, is that if you do this initially, it would appear that there are no backups available. And this definitely happened when I just tried this on my MacBook. So I fired a contacts, hit Time Machine. It went into Time Machine, but initially it only showed today as the checkpoint in time. And I'm like, well, what a piece of junk, man. It didn't back it up. The other thing to note here is that contacts is one of several Apple apps that that offers you a custom interface into Time Machine.
Right.
Which is good to know.
Yeah.
And I think there are like four of them, and I don't know if we've ever summarized them, Dave. I mean, so Contacts, obviously, since we're talking about it now, is certainly one of them where if you launch Time Machine and you're running Contacts, you're not going to get a generic Time Machine screen. It's going to be tuned to that app. And I think the other app that does that most notably is Mail.
Yeah, Contacts, Mail. I believe Calendar does it.
Right. I think there's like, yeah. So I think there's like four apps.
And obviously Finder does it, but that's, you know,
sure.
Sort of the generic way of doing it. Yeah.
So I'm wondering if Felix didn't give it enough time. Because
right.
Looking at mine right now, my backup. So initially it may look like that it doesn't see back in time, but it really did. Like in my case, I'm looking back and it has back to July 2012, which I believe is when I initialized this drive and transferred data over from another drive. So that kind of makes sense.
Now, you bring up a really good point. You glossed over it. So I'm going to reiterate it here.
Ungloss me, brother.
Yeah, because and this happens anywhere, not just Contacts. I see it in the Finder all the time. I bring up Time Machine and the first thing that I see now, Time Machine for me is a backup store to a NAS drive or a time capsule. So it takes the system a little bit of time in the background to parse through this and see what backups you actually have. And while it's doing that, it gives you no indication that that's happening. So as John said,
yes.
When you pull up Time Machine initially, all it shows you is today and it makes it appear like you have no backups. But if you just wait and you have no progress bar, there's no indication that you should be doing this. But if you just wait, it will eventually show you all of what's in there in your backup. So yeah, a little bit of patience with Time Machine when you're trying to restore is your saving grace there. Yeah, because otherwise you start scratching your head and it's like, oh no, we're doomed. So it's good. It's good. All right. Yeah.
Who or what or what is next?
You know, I want to talk about Gazelle, which is our first sponsor for this show. Gazelle, you've heard us talk about this lately. They've been on a little bit of heavy rotation because tis the season for getting new devices, which means you're going to have old devices, Macs, iPhones, iPads, iPods, that you're not going to necessarily know what to do with. And if you don't have a family member or a friend or something that you're going to hand it down to or sell it to directly, you can go to gazelle.com and they will buy the device from you. In fact, I just did this the other day because we, you know, just went through our whole iPhone upgrade thing and we have a couple of extra iPhones and an extra iPod Touch. And so I figured I went online and they gave us good prices for each of these things. And that's what you do. You just go to Gazelle and you tell it what you have and they'll tell you what they'll pay you for it. And then they'll send you a box. And I know this because I have the box. It's sitting in my house. I have 30 days to put everything in the box, send it back to Gazelle. They'll go through it, make sure that I put stuff in the box that I said I would and that it's, you know, in the same condition I said it was in. And then they'll PayPal me the money or send me a check. Or if I'm willing to take it as an Amazon gift card, they'll give me, I think, an extra 5% on that. So check it out. It's gazelle.com and it's a great way to turn your unused gadgets into cash. It's a beautiful thing. And you know, while we're on the subject of gadgets, I will start with my first, albeit a big, this certainly isn't in the stocking stuffer category, but, well, although it would fit in a stocking, it might be a little bit of on the expensive side for something that would be a stocking stuffer. And that is the new iPod Touch. This thing is awesome. The fifth generation iPod Touch. We've had one here for a little while at the house to play with. And my son commandeered it. He's 10. And it really is. He was saying to me today, He said, you know, Dad, this is the best handheld gaming device that I have. And he's tried all of them. And he was a huge Nintendo DS user, right? And loved the DS. But and I said to him, okay, so, you know, a year ago, maybe even a year and a half, even with the fourth generation Touch, which he did have, I said, you know, you gravitated toward your DS quite a bit. I said, what's the difference here? He said, well, first of all, the screen is way better. He said, it's bigger, it's better. He says the battery life is better on the Touch than it was on the DS, which was, like I said, his previous favorite. And he said, the other thing is he can afford the games for it. You know, the DS games are like 40 or 50 bucks a piece, sometimes 30, maybe. So probably realistically 30 to 40 bucks a piece. Whereas iOS games are anywhere from probably a dollar up to what, maybe 10 bucks for a more in-depth title. And he says that way he's got it with him everywhere and he loves it. So really for handheld gaming and for really for a lot of different things, the iPod Touch is my first contribution to our gift guide here. It is so light now and super thin, but the way the back is, it just feels nice in the hand, and they did a nice job with this revision of it. I like it, as you can probably tell. Is good. Do you have anything to throw into the gift guide while I commandeered us here, or should we go back to Jared and soldier forth?
Oh, not at this point.
All right, cool. I've got a couple we'll throw in during the show here. But Jared writes, Jared has this was one of my favorite ones to answer. Jared writes, I'm stoked to be the proud owner of a new 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro. I'm using the external SuperDrive and looking for an easy way to eject a disk, since the optical drive-less Macs don't have an eject key on the keyboard. Sure, I can open a Finder window and eject it from there, but I'm looking for a key combination. Any thoughts? So, in the Finder, Command E will shortcut you to eject. So, I mean, that's better than having to navigate with the mouse potentially, but probably not what you were looking for. I dug around on this one, John, and I couldn't find any pre-built app that would just do this. But I did find the terminal command that I think will eject even the external drive, but it certainly would eject internal drives on Macs. But I think it will also eject this external drive. And that is drutil is the command you're going to run from the terminal. Drutil space tray space eject. And that will cause an eject. Actually, it will cause a tray to go through the eject process, whether or not there is a disk in there. So good way to kind of, if you've got a slot loader and it's stuck, that is another way to kind of force it to do anything. Assuming that works on the 13-inch MacBook Pro, and I don't think we've heard back from Jared on this yet, but if it does, then now that you know the terminal command, you can, if you know the terminal command for something, you can use Automator to make yourself an application that will run that terminal command every time the app is run. And it's really, really simple. You just create a new Automator workflow and use the run shell script action. And then type that same command in. So in this case, drutil space tray space eject. Then you save that. And when you're saving it, you use, there's an option for file format, and you can save it as an Automator an Automator document or something. But option number two is saving it as an application that doesn't require Automator to be running. And you save it as an app, and then anytime you run that app, it ejects your DVD drive. Now, how to take that and automate it or make it even easier? Well, number one is you can put an app in your dock. So you can just click your dock and boom, you can cause that terminal command to be run, and hopefully the disk will eject. Number two, if you don't want to have to click in the dock, you could then use something like Keyboard Maestro to assign a keystroke to launch an application that then ejects the disk. So it sounds more convoluted than it is. It's, you know, you kind of got to go through each little step. I think of this like calculus, right? We have a big problem and we break it down into its little steps, and then suddenly it's not that big anymore. So that's
wow,
my...
Wow, look at the big brain on Dave there.
You like that, huh?
Calculus, yeah. It's been a while since I did integrals and,
well, you know, people,
which is essentially breaking down a big problem into littler problems.
That's it.
And it's manageable.
I tell people,
at least that's my take on calculus and integration, and I guess derivatives in a sense. But
yeah,
Right. Very well done, my friend.
But people, you know, I hear people, kids, especially in school, complain, oh, when am I ever going to use calculus again? And my pat response to that now is I use calculus. I use what I learned in calculus every single day. And it's that, you know, take a big problem. All right. I don't know how to solve this. Well, okay. Can I solve, you know, a smaller version of that? Yes. Okay. Now, how do I get there? And you just piece it together. So that we just pieced it together. That's what we do. So hopefully that works.
We did. And, you know, I remember this a little tangent, but I remember this when I was in high school. Mm-hmm. So I, along with a few others, were in the advanced geek, sure, you know, people that got beat up every day, group.
Yeah, that doesn't happen anymore.
The math nerds.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
No, we didn't get beat up every day.
No, I know. But, I was in the same
group. Still had your divisions, yeah, yeah, yeah. But you had the people that just leaned towards science and math. And so I was in, we actually were taking UConn courses. Yep. And one of the things they did in one of the first calculus courses, first we had functions, then calculus, is we actually, and this is the thing that just blew it open for me. They're like, all right, how do you figure the area under a curve? Which initially may not sound like something that everybody needs to do every day, but it actually lends itself quite easily to the concept you're saying of breaking up a big problem into little problems. Right. And actually what we did at one point, I remember this, Dave, at first we thought, what is the teacher nuts? But we took construction paper and plotted curves and then took construction paper under the curve and then cut it out and proved to ourselves that calculus worked.
That's
like,
huge. Well,
maybe you don't believe that these magic formulas can actually tell you the area under a curve. But once you cut the stuff out and did it with construction paper and actually put it back together, you're like, oh my gosh, this actually works.
That's pretty cool. Just, that's a good,
to me, it's just one
learning.
Of the most fascinating things in their teaching method, which worked great for me, is that let's not just teach you the theory. Let's ground it in something that you can actually see and prove to yourself. And once I saw, oh my gosh, I believe calculus is true.
Right. Yeah. Now, yeah. Now
it's so cool.
That's right. It's not just calculus.
There was no arguing. It's like, physics, all right, the formula says this, and let's let you measure the result and see if you come up with the same number. And yeah. It's like, oh my gosh, I did. Yeah. It was so much fun.
That's cool. All right. So let's hope that, of course, my calculus laden answer here is predicated on the fact that this DR util tray eject will work on the external drive connected to the 13 inch Retina MacBook Pro, which I couldn't test. So I'm hoping that works, but at least, even if it doesn't, for the listening audience kind of at large here, that's the process. Is, you know, if you know a terminal command to solve what you want, you can then take that and run it through, you know, like I said, Automator, and then either as an application or with Keyboard Maestro, you can launch that action, even though it, you know, what you're doing with Automator is building a very single purpose app. But that's part of what it's there for. So use it. It's good stuff. You right. can do it with AppleScript too. It's actually fairly trivial to run a terminal command there too. It's like, I think the action is do shell script quote, and then you just do it. So
yep.
I think.
And to take one quick detour here, but to explain to those who may have not heard this before. So number one, you may be saying, what is this terminal thing that Dave and John are speaking of? And the way you get to that is you go to Applications, Utilities, and there's something called Terminal. If you click on this, you will see a window, which is all text, and that is what the terminal is. But the second thing I want to bring up is that if you want to find out the gory details of what anything does, including DR util that we just spoke about, once you're in the terminal, you type man, which is a manual page, which is kind of like the instructions, space, and if you type man space DR util, you will get a thorough listing of all of the options here, which includes, and I'm looking right now, it says, oh, command verbs include burn, erase, eject, help, info, list. Pretty much, I think it's basically the command line version of what you could otherwise, for the most part, do in either iTunes or Disutility, as far as accessing your CD or DVD burner.
Yeah, right. Cool.
Just a little tangent. Now we're done. Next.
No, it's good stuff. It's good stuff.
Just want to remind people about the roots here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
right.
I think
we forget that sometimes, or is it?
No, you know what? Let's move on a little bit here. Right. Are we good? I mean, we've gone calculus and all right, cool. Now, you know what? I got another one of those things. I got a stocking stuffer for you. This thing's pretty cool. Yeah, no, it's good. It's $10. So that to me falls in and it's the right size. So it fits in the stocking stuffer thing. We all have our earphones, right? And if you don't have a specific case for your earphones, you're trying to like wrap them around your iPhone or whatever. And then invariably, you know, for me, I get on an airplane and I go to rip out my earphones and they're like tangled around everything. It, only magicians understand how cables at rest can tie themselves into knots because magicians leverage that as part of their shows. But the rest of us, we don't understand how it works, but
they do it when we're not looking.
Yeah, that's right.
Concluded.
That's right. And you know, on a tangent here, I would love, absolutely love, if the inside of my computer bag, especially the part where I store cables, was white and not black, because with white, I could know, dude, this makes a huge difference. You can actually see what's in there.
Whereas, I know exactly what you're saying.
You know what I'm talking
about? Rather than fumbling about. Yeah.
It is the reason that in my current car, which I custom ordered, that I had the interior tan and not black. My previous car was black. And I loved it. It looked cool and all that. But, you know, getting in the car after a gig or whatever and trying to find a water bottle or whatever on the floor, it's a black hole. But anyway, so I would love to have a computer bag that's tan or white on the inside. And yeah, I know it would get all scuffed up and not look as pretty a year later as the black one does because you don't see all the scuffs. But I would take that. I'm OK with that. But anyway, that's not
looks versus functionality,
form versus function.
That's or right. Form yeah. Versus function.
So, but I did find this thing called from Digital Innovations called the Nest, and it's an earbud protector. And you'll look at the picture online. You'll say, what the heck is this? But look at some of the other pictures, because what happens is you wrap your earphone. It's like this rubbery thing. And it's like rubbery goodness. You know, it just feels good in your hand. And you you pop your earphones kind of into the middle of this thing, and then you wrap the cord around sort of the outside, and then it has this rubbery flap that just folds over, but it's soft and it's malleable, so you can throw it in your computer bag and it's going to stay together because this fold kind of works that way. And it's awesome, and it's $10, so it's a perfect little stocking stuffer for anyone in the house that has earphones that they're constantly fighting with. It's good stuff. That's that. So, John, what do you got? You got a question from John, don't you?
Oh, man.
No?
You know, I was just lulled by your dulcet tones there.
I'm sorry. I have to say my throat's not perfect, but this current path, this sort of short-term, lots of medication, proton pump inhibitor path, definitely seems to be working for me with the throat. So it's good.
So what did they, have you gone into detail? Do you want to? Or
I think I did on the last show, or 2 shows ago.
Oh, maybe. Yeah. Okay.
I don't know. I forget.
Right. Never mind.
Yeah. I got scoped out. They shoved a scope down my nose to look at my throat.
Prescription is, get meds or regime repair it, or
I am on meds for 6 weeks to get it like under control. Because I got it. You know, the problem is, for whatever reason, the acid's coming up and hitting.
Oh, you told me. Yeah. Acid throat. Reflux. So the acid was standard. Doing bad things to your vocal cords.
Oh, yeah. As it's wont to do. Right. That's sort of, so it's getting better. You know, it's this slow progress thing, but we're definitely going in the right direction. I don't like taking all these meds all the time. But for short term thing, I'm willing to, you know, kind of get over the hump and then figure out what I need to do to deal with it going forward.
All right.
Anyway, go
from John. So yeah. Not me, but another John.
Right.
So here we go. This is a head scratcher. This is a good one, Dave, because I don't know if I have the answer, but I had an answer possibly.
That works for me.
Hi, Dave, John, and Pilot Pete. And I also say hi to Pilot Pete, wherever he may be. Any idea why my late 2008 MacBook Pro's hard drive is reporting more available gigabytes than its capacity when I select info from the hard drive? I recently did a clean install of Mountain Lion, repaired permissions, etc. However, when I select this utility, the proper information is displayed. I'm wondering if this is a bad omen of things to come. I have been having an issue with this MacBook Pro as of late where the Wi-Fi becomes unresponsive, won't connect or allow shutting off, and it only recovers if I reboot or boot to recovery and then follow with a normal boot. AppleCare replaced the airport Wi-Fi card a few weeks ago and then things worked, but the symptom has returned a few times lately. Oh boy. So my response, and this is certainly open for discussion because I, so the one thing that gets me is whenever you see two different programs give you different numbers or two programs that should be reporting the same thing that are not. Oh boy. So basically I said to him, thanks so much for the screenshot, which really helped us for both Dave and I quantify and observe and, yeah, let me, and see what.
Let me explain what these screenshots show, right? I mean, this is, it's not just like a little bit of discrepancy. His hard drive in the Finder, it says it's got it's got 250 gigs, 249.2 gigs of capacity. The
and
Finder,
that sounds like a standard Apple offering. Okay. Right. So I'll go with that. It's a 250 gig drive.
Sure. The Finder says that 331.68 gigs are available. That's bad. That, I mean, that's
awesome.
Yeah, that's magic is what it is.
Where'd you get all that extra space?
Yeah.
Dude? So
yeah, that's disk doubler. Don't you remember that disk doubler from like the OS, whatever, 7 days? Yeah. Disk utility, though, shows that only 47.7 gigs are available. So there's a, it's not like we're doing math slightly differently. And so it's showing it a little bit different. It's like totally FUBAR in the Finder.
Right. Because there is an issue, which I think has pretty much been settled, where the way computer people measure a gig and the way the rest of the world measures a gig is different.
Gigabits and gibby bits, I believe, are the, is the right. discussion that, we have
the,
there.
Basically, the problem is that computer people measure things in power of two. And when you were talking 1024 versus 1,000, okay, that wasn't a big deal. But once you start getting past kilobytes and start talking megabytes and gigabytes and terabytes, then the difference in the way people measure things is substantial. And I think there were actually, and now Apple and everybody explains this saying, okay, a gig isn't really a gig. Well, a gig is the gig we like. But not the, the real gig
right.
computer people use.
But anyway, that's not this discussion. This is, there's a problem.
Certainly not. Right. No. Here, it's a problem. And so here were my thoughts on this. So I basically checked my machine because he's running Mountain Lion, I think he indicated. And I checked my machine and I didn't see it. So it's not a systemic problem in Mountain Lion. One thought that I had is that it could be a subtle bug in the Finder.
Seems now, like more than subtle.
But it's a bug in the Finder. So one thing is that it could be a bug in the Finder where even though the Finder and Disk Utility are looking at the same data.
Yeah,
I'm going to offer it as an option because especially as of late in my new role doing software to talk to environmental measurement devices, I have seen this happen where if somebody doesn't specifically define the format of a piece of data and you get into the signed bit and this and that is 16, 32, 48, however many bits, you'll get a piece of software that'll see the same piece of data, but will display it differently because it wasn't necessarily told how to display it or they're just some sort of problem. So what I'm saying is that there's a potential for two different pieces of software to look at the same piece of data from a device like how many bytes do I have free and display it maybe wrong.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's happening in this case, but
I would like to insert an adjective before wrong, you know, like very, very, that was two, but really, you know,
right.
Yeah. Egregiously.
So the thing is the Finder. So the thing is number one, the Finder may just have a bug in it where it's not displaying this right. And Disk Utility is correct.
Maybe.
And that nothing is wrong, but I think something is wrong.
Yeah, I agree with you.
So what I would say is that maybe try a third tool.
Okay.
Well, I don't know if it'll fix the problem, but it'll help give you the piece of data here. So the other tool I would suggest for this, Dave, is System Information. Oh. And if you go to the Hardware Serial ATA category, it will show you a little bit more detail than you may be used to seeing, and that you will see not only the values that you should be seeing from Finder and Disk Utility, but you may see some things about some of the other partitions on the drive. And maybe looking at that, maybe you can make sense of what you're seeing.
Yeah.
The other thing is that you have damage that is getting worse. And this is the first sign.
Yeah.
But yeah. In my humble opinion, I would say what you're seeing, my gut here tells me, although, you know, I suggested other things, my gut tells me that you do have a little piece of damage, and Finder happens to be picking it up first and not this utility. So.
Yeah. So I, my feeling on this is,
how do you solve a problem? Cause I would say that this is a problem where you have directory corruption, not necessarily data,
yeah,
but the part of the drive that keeps track of everything is getting confused, or it's corrupted, or something's wrong. And this utility, I think it was mentioned, this utility was tried. It's not always, no, that's right. Well, he says, I tried this utility, and it says the proper information is displayed. So I guess
but he hasn't run repairs in disk utility. And I think that's the first thing to do, right? Because there are there are times in the repair process where you'll see fixing free block count, and it's not fixing, maybe it's just repairing or something, but there is a part of disk utility's repair disks process that goes through this. Now you can't run that on your boot drive though. You've got to boot from even the recovery partition in Mountain Lion is enough to let you do that because it's a different partition. So that definitely the first thing I would do. Yeah, no question. And hopefully that'll fix it. You talked about other tools to check this. Terminal gives you access to lots and lots of great tools. And my favorite one for looking at disk space is DF. Delta Foxtrot. So Delta Foxtrot space -H hotel, right? So it's a 4-character with a space in the middle of them all. And it will show you all your things, and it will show you how it's, what it's named and the size and how much is used and all that good stuff. So that's another way to check to see if, where that reports. If that shows you that you've got more free than you actually have total on the drive, that indicates that there's a, right. It's not a bug in the Finder. Yeah.
Now, a specific tool that I've used, and I've actually had problems like this in the past, Dave. So one that I will recommend here, it's our pals at ProSoft, and they make something called Drive Genius. And one of the features that I like about Drive Genius is that it has not only functions that mirror disk utility, like, you know, check this directory, but it also has a feature which I think is pretty unique to maybe not. It's certainly unique in commercial products, I think. I haven't seen any free products, but it does have, and I've used this, a thing called Rebuild Directory. That I think what it does, it basically scrubs the directory. It says, you know what? This directory is a mess. I'm just going to erase it. And then I'm going to go through the other data structures on the drive, and I'm going to rebuild your directory for you from scratch. And I've actually had that work for me in the past, where it was damage that was not detected by disk utility. But once I ran this part of Drive Genius, it said, you know what? This is trash, dude. I'm going to rebuild it. And then everything was great. And part of the problem was there was absolutely, when I ran this, a discrepancy in the amount of files, in this case, that the hard drive thought was on it and what was really on it. Yeah. So, and then we see in the chat room here, we have people mentioning also Drive Genius is my current favorite. And I think you like it too, Dave. It was also mentioned here that Disk Warrior is another worthy candidate for doing more thorough directory repair.
Actually, Drive Genius does this too, but Disk Warrior, its main feature and arguably its only feature is to do directory rebuilding. So I don't believe it does repairs much as it does a rebuild.
So like Drive Genius. Yeah. So it basically trashes what's there and rebuilds it from the other data. And hopefully you get a good result. Okay.
But Drive Genius will do a repair as well as a rebuild. So you can choose either or obviously both, but it's a little bit overkill. Yeah. So, while we're on this subject, John, you had another one. You had a note from Mike about a damaged disk. He has I'll summarize his question and then I'll let you kind of take it. But he has a disk that has data on it, but it won't mount. But he knows that there's data out there. He just can't get to it. So the question is, how do I get these data files off of this disk? And in his case, a disk is actually an SD card. But I'm curious how you would go ahead and solve this, John.
Well, I offered a couple of things. Now, actually, I didn't know it was an SD card, but I thought it was a disk image.
I think maybe it's a disk image
on an SD card.
Yeah, it's a weird. Okay. Yeah. Oh no, well, he makes images of his SD. Yeah, go ahead and tell and walk through it.
All right. Well, I'll start with the question. Do you have any suggestions for how to view data in a disk image that will not mount?
Right.
And here's the background. I have remote data collection sites that take all data hike into. Oh, cool. Oh, we got to talk about this more. I normally take my computer to the site, pull the SD cards, plug them into the built-in SD reader, and pull the data. I recently installed Mountain Lion, and now this process no longer works. Sucks. When sticking the card in, it did not mount, but it did show up in Disk Utility with daylight gone. The only thing I could think of was to use Disk Utility's restore function to create a disk image. However, the image does not open. Getting the error, no mountable file system. Within Disk Utility, I see the information in the partition map scheme. No partition map. Ew. Yeah, this does sound related, Dave.
Yeah.
I would think that my cause is hopeless except for one very promising sign. When I run first aid in Disk Utility, it says there are 673 files, which met his expectations. So all I wanted to do is find some way to grab these data files. Any thoughts? Mike, your neighbor up in Lyme, which is in Connecticut. We got to thank for Lyme disease. Thanks, Lyme.
That's actually the island off the coast of Lyme, Connecticut, where Lyme disease was invented. But, you know, that's...
Thanks.
But Lyme was...
You know
Lyme.
About that with with your whole fiasco there.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness.
Yep.
So I offered a couple of things, and then I'll give it to you, Dave. I'm sure you have some more. But Mike, one program that will let you view the contents of any file without having to mount it is HexEdit, and I think that's what he's looking for. And this is something that I've been using for a while, Dave, and it's a... I don't know if I call it a sector editor, but it's definitely a low-level file editor in that its purpose in life is you run this program, you point it to a file, whether it be a disk image, and I actually verified it, it'll read any file that you point it to, and then it will give you a display that is pretty geeky. It's pretty much the raw, as the name of the utility implies, hex data in the file. It also, I think, can display an ASCII and other things. So a tool like this in general is probably a good thing to have in your tool belt or tool case or tool purse or whatever you wear your tools on to view data within a file. The Mac OS really, as far as I know, other than, you know, primitive things like cat and all that, really don't give you an ability to look at the raw data inside a file. HexEdit does that. And it looks, based on what I know, it's been around for a long time, Dave. So this is one thing I would try. Again, our pals at Drive Genius, I believe Drive Genius has a sector editor as well. And I think some of the other disk utilities do also, which basically let you skip either looking at a file and looking at the raw contents or kind of skipping the whole file thing and just looking at the raw data on the hard drive. The last tool I'll mention, again, another plug for our buddies at ProSoft, is that Data Rescue is a good utility because Data Rescue is a utility that will look at a piece of media and kind of piece together what it thinks the data or data files on it should be. And it's especially useful if you've done boneheaded things like deleting stuff when you shouldn't have, or that these bad things just happen to people because bad things happen to good people. So, but I like Data Rescue and they have a free demo so you can actually test it. And I think what happens on the free demo, I believe you can only recover a limited number of files that it does find and identify as files that it found that you normally would not find. Right. So that's cool. My story, Dave, but you got to have, do you have more for me, Dave?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure that I do. I would go with Data Rescue. You know, you can do a Google search and find utilities that will allow you to recover stuff directly from an SD card, like utilities that are built for it. In fact, there's one that I found at datarescue.com, which is not related to ProSoft, which is interesting.
Get the lawyers out.
Well, you know, I think they might have been around first before ProSoft had Data Rescue.
Oops.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. But that's more geared toward pulling photos off of SD cards. So them, and I don't know exactly what type of data that Mike is trying to pull, but that would be one way to do it. So that's what I got.
Groovy.
The other thing I had, actually, I just shipped it off to Jim Tanis here at TMO for a more in-depth review. But the other thing that I had for the last week or two was a Drobo 5D. The 5D is their new Thunderbolt accessible, also USB 3 accessible, 5-bay unit. So if you're familiar with the Drobos, and I know you are, John, but for the sake of our listeners, this will be a familiar looking thing. It looks a lot like the old Drobos or even the Drobo FS, because it's just got five bays for SATA disks in there. The way Drobos work in general, and this one is no different, is that you just put disks in and then it expands its capacity based on what the disks are. And you don't have to really worry about it. And if you need to replace one of the disks, you just pull the disk out and you can replace it with a larger version and the Drobo will magically increase your capacity. The 5D was an interesting thing to test because it adds one thing to what we've been used to on a Drobo, John. And that is there's a SATA, it's not a drive. It's an M SATA card that you put, you actually put it in the bottom of this thing. They sent me one and it had a 64 gig M SATA card to put in. And it's just, you know, like installing a RAM chip. In fact, it is installing a RAM chip of sorts in the bottom of the thing. And then it does some kind of like, fusion drive type stuff inside there to put data on the SD portion that, you know, you might want more frequently, and it makes it faster. And of course, when you've got multiple drives in something, even if the drives aren't super fast themselves, if the data is spread across all these drives, well, then you can actually get some decent throughput out of it. And over Thunderbolt, I was getting like writes were somewhere in the neighborhood of about 180 megabytes a second. And this is with like really normal standard SATA drives, nothing special. And reads, I was getting over 200 megabytes a second with kind of sustained reads. And this is from the Finder. Huh. Yeah. Yeah. Like normal, you know, reading movie files or you know, music files, big stuff back and forth. It was cooking. It was really impressive. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see where they take this technology. And I am looking forward to the future of it, but this is a great thing for them because they've, you know, their Direct Connect stuff, we've always had good luck with. Their network stuff, frankly, we have not had great luck with, but their Direct Connect stuff has always worked and it's always been snappy to sort of navigate around. But as far as the speeds of getting data on and off of it, not so much. You know, it really wasn't built to be this super speed demon, but this one is a different thing. Yeah. Yeah. So it was cool to test out. Yeah. I liked it. Yeah.
Cool. Now I saw their kind of mini version, which is one that I think is mainly geared towards housing SSDs.
Right.
At first it was just adorable. Mini.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just adorable. And with SSDs in there, I mean, this thing's smoking and I think they have the same interface options or if not, they will offer them soon as far as USB and Thunderbolt, I think. And it's funny to see at the shows I've been to lately that it seems everybody all of a sudden is falling in line. Well, once USB 3 got a thumbs up, then a lot of people said, or it could be whoever offered the chipset. It's like, yeah, let's offer Thunderbolt and USB 3.
Right.
Those are good choices.
And the Drobo actually ships with both a USB 3 and a Thunderbolt cable, which is kind of, I mean, it's just, you know, it's a nice perk because Thunderbolt cables aren't cheap. Of course, the Drobo's not cheap either. I think the 5D is $849 and the Drobo Mini that does the SSDs is $649. And that's like empty. No mSATA card, no drives. Yeah. But that's what you're going to pay for this type of stuff. I mean, it's in the neighborhood of what you're going to pay for this type of stuff. Yeah, it's interesting.
And in the room here, we got a question from Lori saying megabytes. And the answer is yes. Well, even traditional drives, I think, can do this. But now that we're in a whole new world with USB 3 and Thunderbolt
it's RAID, right? I know Drobo is not doing traditional RAID in that sense, but it's, you know,
but
using the speed of all the drives together. And then at the same time, this high speed mSATA thing, which is an SSD drive that's sort of sitting in there, you know, you put all that together the right way, which obviously they have. And it was snappy. Yeah, I was really impressed with it. Yeah.
Yeah, so it used to be that the bus was the limiting factor or the drive speed. And right now, I think the limiting factor for the most part now is the speed of the drive itself.
Yeah, but that was the case.
Drives.
Yeah. Yeah, that was even the case with FireWire 800 for a lot of drives. Not for everything, but for a lot of drives. Yeah. Yeah. So it's, you know, this RAID stuff is good. It's good. All right.
Look at the clock.
Is the clock still ticking for some reason?
It's always ticking. I don't know how this works exactly.
Let me look. Oh, we already took care of Mike. We took care. We talked about that. We've got good stuff here, John. We're all over on here.
We got your rant here. I don't know about that.
Yeah. So let's. We've got a couple of tips. So we'll start with one from listener Cat Food. Sort of a response to what we were talking about last week when we had that mail issue where the user had different versions of mail on their drive. And Cat Food writes, I too have had trouble with the latest regular security update for macOS 10.10.6.8. He's still on Snow Leopard. I had organized my applications folder so that Safari and mail were in a subfolder called Internet. When I installed the update, the original mail app in the Internet folder and the newer updated mail app was put in the applications folder. Neither would work, popping up a dialogue stating that it was not the correct version for my computer. After some searching on the internet, I ended up deleting both mail applications and then running the combo update again, which fixed the problem. And the lesson there that I want to share with everybody is, as nice as it would be to subcategorize your applications folder into different stuff, it's really, the system just isn't built to work that way anymore. You have to leave, especially Apple apps, have to be at the top of the applications folder. Otherwise, the updaters aren't going to see them, and it's going to cause all kinds of weird problems. So that's the tip to be gleaned from that is, it used to be nice. And in OS 9, of course, we did it all the time. We made, my applications folder had, probably 6 or 8 subfolders in it for different stuff, and it was nice. But no, that's not. Unless the app installs itself into its own subfolder, you don't want any subfolders there other than the utilities folder. And don't move stuff around in there either. Especially Apple apps. So that's that. I did have a little bit of a rant, John. Well, it's not really a rant, but again, more of a heads up. And It was that I wanted to have a brief discussion about Java. People... And I understand why,
What's Java, Dave? Please tell me for those that don't know.
Okay. Yeah. Java is it's a computer language, but it is, in simple terms, it's a language that allows you to easily write stuff for multiple platforms without changing anything at all. You write one app and then it in a lot of cases can just be run inside a, Java engine on any computer. You could run it on a Mac, you could run it on Windows, you could run it on Linux, and the same app will run. So cross-platform very, very easily. But Apple recently has decided to not install Java by default with the OS. And there's actually a very good reason for that. It means that Apple no longer has to be on point to push out an update to Java every time a security update is issued. Now you get Java directly from Oracle or wherever. And then they, when they push a security update, you get it. But because of that, a lot of people have, and I've seen this in emails that I've gotten from a lot of you, there seems to be this hesitation to install Java because it's a potential security risk. And in a sense, it is a potential security risk, but if you need it for whatever program you're going to run, it's not like some horrible thing that's just going to run amok all over your computer. What it means is you can run Java apps. And so if you download some nefariously written Java app, then yes, you will have problems. But for example, if you need to run CrashPlan, which I know John and I both run, then just download Java and run it. It's okay. It's not, it's not a bad thing.
Well, but the problem to me, Dave, is that Apple brought this on themselves.
Right.
The problem with Java on the Mac as of late is that Apple sucks at issuing Java updates.
Right.
So for whatever reason, Apple insisted, no, Oracle, Sun, whoever it is now, it's Oracle now. So it's under Oracle, they own Java. Apple was like, we're going to, even though you guys are generating the, or maybe they weren't, and I don't know how this relationship started, but at one point Apple decided, we're good enough where we can update these, we can issue these updates under our own banner. And they certainly let people do that.
Right.
In the Java ecosphere. The problem is Apple totally dropped the ball in the last security update. And there was this whole big I wouldn't call virus, but malware thing, where basically Apple didn't acknowledge or issue an update for a known Java bug for many, many months. So to me, Apple screwed up. And I think it's good that Apple is no longer taking responsibility and that you pointed out, Dave. And I tried this too, to look into another Java question. But the thing is, now, if you don't have Java on your machine and it wants it, it'll say, oh, yeah, go to Oracle, and that they'll let you download it.
Yeah.
And you should download their version instead. And I think that's a good decision.
Yeah, I think it's really good decision.
Apple, for whatever reason, was not equipped to handle this update in a timely fashion. So right. They just said, yeah, we're not going to do it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
But it's not evil. Java is a platform, and it's certainly viable. And if you need it, and you're going to know, because the OS will come up and say, yeah, Java's not here. I verified this because I hadn't tried lately, Dave. You know, it's funny because even though CrashPlan is still running on my MacBook Pro with Mountain Lion.
Yeah.
I actually went to a web page that required the Java plugin, and that actually came up and said, whoa. No, it's not here. You want to download it from Oracle? And I'm like, yeah, sure.
Right.
Cool. And I think it'll lead to a question that I'm still researching, which is the conflict between now the Oracle implementation and the Apple implementation, because I think there may be cases where both of them will be asking you on your Mac, hey, you want me to update? And it's like, oh boy.
That's bad. Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard scattered reports of a conflict. In my case, again, I tried to run something and it pointed at the OS itself pointed me to the Oracle site. So there may be people get caught in the handoff phase.
Yeah.
Still going to be trying to install the Apple version versus the approved Oracle version. And there could be confusion. So heads up to people.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, I think it's time to bring the band in, my friend.
The band.
'Tis the time. Of course, we would have so much more to go through, but it's just, you know, it's how we have to prioritize, and here we are.
We could do a 10x accelerated version of the show.
That's right. Well, if you want to listen to the show at faster speed, you could download the Mac Geek Gab iOS app, because you can listen at 1.2 or 1.5. We found 2.0 was just a little, I talk too fast.
Yeah.
But for those of you that already have the app, an update is coming. It was submitted to the App Store, I'm going to say Thursday, and today's Sunday. And who knows when they'll get to it, because that's kind of how they work. But it fixes a couple of bugs. It fixes the 3G streaming bug, which we know was hitting quite a few of you. But it also allows you to listen to the live chat. Stream and participate in the chat. It is enhanced for full glory on the iPhone 5, so that's good. And I think there's one other thing that off the top of my head I just can't remember, but it's good stuff. So that update's coming this week, and if you don't have the app, well, maybe it's time to go get it. You want to tell them how to contact us if they don't have the app, John?
If you don't have the app and you have email, which I'm going to assume that you all do, but if you don't, then I don't know what to say. But you could send an email to feedback@macgeekgab.com if you'd like to give us a question, comment, a tip, pretty much anything.
That's
well,
right.
Not anything, but most things.
Feedback at macgeekgab.com is what you said.
Okay. Now I'm going to make sure that you heard me, Dave, that I indeed said feedback@macgeekgab.com. But that's not the only address. There's also, Dave, surprisingly enough, premium@macgeekgab.com.
Premium@macgeekgab.com. For those of you that are direct supporters of the show via MacGeekGab Premium, premium@macgeekgab.com. You can learn more about Premium at macgeekgab.com/premium. And that's where you can sign up and we're putting together what will be the first charter member premium gift that will most likely be shipping out in about a month or so, probably a month and a week, because I'm going to be away for that in a month. But so that's all coming together. You can go and check all that out. John, if they wanted to call us, they would dial 206-666-GEEK, which is
43. 35, but that's not all. You can also There's this thing called Facebook that I just heard about, Dave. And if you go to facebook.com/netgeekgab, there's a page there where you can learn about when the show is happening, submit questions if you like, and just get a warm, fuzzy feeling about being part of the NetGeekGab Facebook community.
That's right.
But that's not all, Dave. There's more, right?
But wait, there's less. On the Facebook thing, if you sign up there, you can then see when we are going to be recording the live stream, and that way you see the schedule. It's typically, I think we're shooting for this 5 p.m. ish Eastern on Sunday thing, right? Because that way John's not asleep at showtime, and neither am I, and that's a good thing. So, and that seems to have worked out well today, which is when we did it. So, so I think we're going to stay here. We will occasionally do a Sunday morning one for both scheduling and just preference reasons. It is kind of nice to do a morning show every now and then. So, but I think I think next week we're on for the 5 o'clock time slot. But if you join facebook.com/MattGeekGab, you can see when those pop up. You can also find the announcements for the live show and everything else that we do on Twitter. The show is at Matt Geekab. John is at John F. Braun. I'm at Dave Hamilton. And then you can find Pilot Pete at Pilot Pete and Mac Observer at Mac Observer. That's good. It's all good. It's all happening at the zoo, John. What else you got? One more thing for me, maybe?
Michael? Michael? How about Michael?
Well, we have any more contact information, I meant. Yeah. Of course, we're going to thank Michael Johnston because he's the one that converts the show to AAC.
Is there more contact? I mean, we have the phone number, the email, the Facebooks, the internets.
I think that's it.
Or the Twitters.
I think it's good.
Until Skype. We come up with something new.
Yeah. You can Skype us at MattGeekGab. Just sends into the phone number. So that's good. Yeah. All right. John, I think it's time to let the band play us out. Right? Yeah, good.
I hope so.
Sort of a messy transition on that. I gotta get that transition better. Anyway, we did. We wanted to thank Michael, which we did. We wanted to thank CashFly.com for the bandwidth in getting the show from us to you. The podcast marketplace, of course, includes Gazelle, as we mentioned, PDF Pen for Mac, iPhone, and iPad, BB Edit from Barebones Software, all that good stuff. John, if you had one bit of lasting advice that you wanted to share with everyone until we're back next week, what would that be? One bit.
For goodness sake, don't get caught.
Made up.